Every single day, people take unwanted or unused items to thrift and antique stores across the country. But as the saying goes, one man's trash is another man's treasure, and we're here to prove it. Identify valuable things before you throw them away. Join us as we show and tell of treasures found and sold by a full-time reseller with the hopes of helping you find some treasures of your own. Welcome to the What's Sold podcast.
Welcome back to the What's Sold podcast. As usual, I am Brandon. This is Matt.
Hello.
And we are here to talk about selling stuff or buying stuff or finding really treasures. In fact, I thought about that. Interestingly, you kind of said that treasures. And I'm like, man, some of the stuff you've showed on here really are treasures. You think about a sort of modern day, like treasure hunters that go down into holds of ships. Mm-hmm. And I often think about, you know, in context of this show, there are a lot of hidden treasures out there. We play Zelda.
Uh-huh.
My daughter plays on Nintendo. And I have to admit, I do love video games. I can't play them because I can't stop. But, you know, in this game, there's just searching for all these hidden gems and treasures. I like to think of that.
Is this an original NES situation? Is this the old school? Okay.
No. Well, I think it is definitely based on the old school Legend of Zelda. But it's not Legend of Zelda. It's the newer version, and it's actually much cooler. But yeah, it's good. It's very good. Same idea, same story, same background.
That was the NES came out when I was at the right age. You know,
yeah.
I was like five or six, and I got it and played it, and I would jerk that control. I mean, I was just making a jump. You'd jerk it, you'd pull the plug out of the machine, you know, and my parents would be like, "If you do it one more time, you know, we're done for today." A few months ago, I came across one and bought it. And I also had one of these really old school TVs. It was a Zenith, I'm trying to remember the model, but it was one of those convex glass screen. It weighs, you know, 100 pounds.
Yeah.
Super heavy.
Yeah.
And I thought this will be awesome. I'm going to set it up next to my desk. I'm going to work. And if I want to take a break, I'm just going to turn over and play some. I had some old games from when I grew up. And so I did that. I hooked it all up. And the first day, I'm like, I'm going to do this. And I put on, it was like Mario 3.
Yeah.
Right? You remember Mario 3 with the tail and you can fly and all this stuff. And I got on playing. And I mean, I got maybe not even 5 minutes into it. And I was like, oh man, this is boring. I can't do that. I was so excited. I'm like, I'm going to relive my childhood. And it did not keep my attention at all. I had nobody by me. And it's very promptly sold all that stuff. Because like, why am I going to?
Yeah. Some of that stuff has not aged well. Some of it has. Some of it's really fun. Some of it, Maple got into Galaga, which was kind of fun.
Uh-huh.
I mean, some of the stuff is, but ultimately, the leaps and bounds that video games have taken since you were a kid and I was a kid, I started on the Atari 5200. That dates me, you know, so old school, like Space Invaders and all that, Space Invaders, whatever they called it.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at it now. Do you remember Tecmo Bowl? Everybody had like...
Oh, Tecmo Super Bowl. Oh, yeah. I played that so much. I had a buddy and you could play a whole season, right? And then you end up playing in Super Bowl. And it would take us days or weeks to kind of... And we would do it over and over again. Oh, yeah.
If Tecmo Super Bowl.
It's in the top 10.
Oh, the graphics are so horrifically bad.
Yeah.
It's ironic, though, in the last, I want to say 10 to 15 years, the graphics haven't gotten so much better compared to what they were like the 10 or 15 years before that.
I mean, when it went from NES, I remember when Sega Genesis came out and Sonic the Hedgehog. And going from Mario to Sonic the Hedgehog was like a whole
light
new
years.
World. I mean, that was crazy.
Yeah, I still think Sonic the Hedgehog is one of the greatest games ever made. It's just, if you've played it recently, it still holds up. It's just a really cool game.
It was just the speed.
Yes.
I mean, the graphics were awesome, but it's moving in some cases faster than you can really keep up, which is saying something. So anyways.
Yeah, we're not here to talk about it, but we should do a show on video games at some point.
Oh, yeah.
Because I guarantee
you
there's probably a huge aftermarket for old video games, right?
There is, in fact. Yeah, everything going back to NES for sure, even Atari and sort of derivatives of those.
For those of you listening, NES stands for Nintendo Entertainment System. That was the...
It was a video game system.
Yes, a video game system.
Decades ago.
Interestingly, that wasn't the very first system, but that was really the first system that went, in a sense, viral. Like, everybody had one.
Popular, commercially available to most places. Yeah.
Exactly. Because the 5200 and the Atari, those were out there, but it wasn't that just system just blew everything up. And there was just many games that were on there that people of our age and ilk can remember, the, you know, swinging across the, what was the one you swang across the, in the jungle? I think it was like Jungle Hunter, whatever that was. Anyway.
Ooh,
yeah.
Yeah. There were hundreds of games, yes, which is cool for sure. Nice. Well, I guess I'll slip into showing a few things that sold.
Oh yeah. Let's do it.
This week I was actually doing fulfillment this morning. I start my days off. I get up pretty early. My kids have to be out the door early, but there's this period of time between my daughter goes to school and when my son goes to school, and we have like another 45 minutes. So he usually plays with some toys down here in what I call the warehouse, which is my office area where I store things. And I fulfill, I purchase the labels, package it all up. And then in some cases I bring it with me, and on my way home from dropping him off, I drop stuff at the post office and I'm home by 8:45 and I've already, I've got some work done. But some stuff today, I haven't packaged it yet because I saved it for this, and I'll just hold up a handful of these. I'll take photos and we'll have these available on our Facebook page. But these are just some costume jewelry necklaces. This is like one with small beads, black beads, these are glass, and then some pink cut glass beads. And then another one, larger beads that are glass as well. These are kind of like handmade glass beads. And then some little pink beads in between. I'll show you a couple of more. These are all sort of similar in the same vein. They're just costume necklaces. They got some bigger round glass beads with swirly kind of colors in them and some pink kind of beads in between. So I sold these each in lots of two necklaces in one and two in the other. And they sold for $20 each. Mm-hmm. And these are things that I got out of costume jewelry lots. So I'll get a lot of 100 pieces. I'll take 5 out, sell them really quickly. I'll make all my money back. So now I have the rest, 90, 95 objects left with no cost of goods. And so sometimes I bundle those in small lots, 2, 4, 5 items per lot. And then I send them on auction. So these sold on auction. If I were to buy these individually, I would never pay more than $3 for one of these. So there were four items. They sold for $40. And had I bought these individually, I'd have been in $12 at the most. But in this case, I can sell them. I eat the fees and I have to save my taxes, but I have no cost of goods. And I try to keep cost of goods at 20% or less. And most of the time I'm much less than that. But meaning if I'm going to sell something for $10, I had better not have paid more than $2 for it. And we know from earlier episodes, that's not even a good enough margin for me on smaller items. I want to do it 10 times my cost for things that cost $20 or less. Point is, these are out there. You can get them at thrift stores and things like that, $3 or less most of the time.
I know this isn't necessarily a sexy topic, but I think we do need to talk at some point about how taxes work and how all those costs are kind of, I think a lot of people think, oh, I'm just going to go on eBay or I'm going to go on these things and I bought it for 10, I'm going to sell it for 20. It doesn't work that way. You've talked about it on this show, but I think that we're going to have to go more in depth because I'm often thinking to myself, well, what does he hold back in taxes? And, anybody that owns their own business and creates their own content or their own sells goods has got to deal with this kind of stuff. So at what level do you get an accountant? And so I just said a thought of something that we should talk about at some point on the show.
Yeah, we definitely do need to devote. And I'm not an accountant and I'm not an attorney. So we'll give that disclaimer if and when that time comes. I can only tell you kind of what I do. But last thing I'll show real quick is this little ring. It's got a black stone, the polish on the top of it.
Looks like a class ring.
It does kind of. The stone is called onyx. It's a black, often slick. You can be facet cut stones out of it as well, but it's a mineral. And then this is a sterling silver ring. It's probably a women's ring, even though it's quite large, just because of the size. It's about a size 6, 6.5. But this sold for $20. I bought this with a bunch of other costume jewelry. So again, I don't have any cost of goods in this. But anytime I have a small piece of sterling silver jewelry, whether it has stones in it or not, whether it's a brooch, a pair of earrings, a ring, I'm going to get about $20 or more pretty much every time. As long as I leave it up, I'm going to sell things for $20. And I have a ton of stuff in a store right now like this, like these other necklaces. And sometimes they sell in the first auction cycle. Sometimes they don't. If they don't, I put them up as a buy it now, and then they sell in a month or two. But just as a quick update, so I have multiple stores that I operate and sell out of on eBay specifically. I have an Etsy store. I sell locally, sometimes on Facebook Marketplace for larger items. And then I have a room at an antique store in Asheville that I sell at. But I had an experiment going this year where I started an eBay store, and I have not done any work in it myself. I actually have employed as a contractor a person to list items in that store for me. We're about 3.5 months in, about three months in or so into this experiment. What I do is when I buy large lots of smaller items, like what I've discussed today, I buy a lot. Again, I'll pull out the more valuable things. I'll sell them fast. Now I have no cost of goods in these. And what I do is I move them in batches of 100 or 200-300 items off to this person. And they, I pay them a per listing amount. I pay $1 or $1.10, something like that, for each listing that they do. So far, I was looking at it this morning, from starting a store from scratch, like nothing in it, 3.5 months in, there's somewhere around 2,500 items wow. currently in the store. They've listed that many for me in 3 months. And I've sold 181 listings. So that listing could have been an individual item. A listing could have been a lot. But 181 transactions. And so in that time, that much, and that percentage, by the way, I looked it up, is 7.24%. So in a three-month period, 7.24% of the items listed, or the listings made, sold. With that 7%, it's been enough money to come in to pay that worker for their work, and enough money for me to hold back in taxes, and I even have made a little bit of income. I'm not doing this to make a bunch of money immediately. I'm able to give a person a job, which is awesome. And what this allows me to do is, while I'm working in a store individually, I'm building up my inventory in another store. And as long as I can pay my costs, like I get my costs back and I can pay them, I don't have to worry about making the money. But at this rate, at this pace, by the end of the year, I'm going to have over 10,000 items in a store, and it will have cost me nothing, essentially, because I will have sold the items to get my cost of goods back. And so then we're kind of rocking and rolling. If any time I want to back off.
What if part of it is once you sell the items, you got to box them up and ship them out. Have you ever thought about, so you have this person that's doing the listings and they're just kind of cranking through listings. At some point you get 10,000 items in there. Does it behoove you? Have you looked at the numbers on like, hey, I'm just going to hire this person to run this channel. And since you've already, there's no work involved in it. Whatever you take, even if it's, I don't know, 2%, it's just basically free money. Have you ever thought about turning that over to somebody and say, you run with it and I'll just check in?
I certainly could. I think that the challenge with changing the way that that operates is that the way that it's set up currently, I can hire this person as a contract employee and they're doing things in batches. So each time I give a batch of 100 or 200 items, that's almost like an individual agreement. This worker is agreeing to take some parameters that I give them, do this work for me as a contracted individual service that I'm going to pay them for. When that's done, we can be done. Or if they want to re-up, we do it again. And in order, by doing it that way, they qualify legally as a contracted employee, which means I only pay them the fee that we've agreed to, and I am under no obligation to pay any sort of employee taxes or whatever. They're not a W-2 employee. However, if I change the way in which they do the work, if I start giving them more responsibilities and I give them timetables and I give them all the stuff, it starts to get cross into, you know, the definitions of what a W-2 employee is. And if I do that, then there are some other changes I have to make and there are some costs that I'll incur. Now, it still might be worth it, right? Especially when it gets to that level, to have them kind of operate that. And I would have to put in some time to train them to do the fulfillment and get them a label maker and all of that. It wouldn't be hard to do. I could teach them all of that in a week or a week's time or less. It's more for me about, yeah, kind of keeping it sort of low key, low scale. It also affords them a lot of freedoms. So they can work at their own leisure. Mm-hmm. There's no certain number that they have to do per week, or I'm not over their shoulder watching them and calling them if they're not doing stuff. Like, it's very laid back for sure. If I want to scale up in that way, I could certainly do it. And I'll have to look at the numbers. It might make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really an economies of scale issue, ultimately, at the end of the day. Does it make sense? And what I'm saying is that someone that's listening to this, and maybe a lot of people are just starting out doing this, but you've gotten to a point where your business is cranking out. I'm thinking to myself, you know, I've talked to a couple people, they're starting like I mentioned, my brother starting a golf shop and an online golf shop. It's like anything else. I mean, if you have to look at the tipping point, if it makes more sense to hire somebody, but that's going to bring its own headaches with it. But it might be worth it if you can make more money from that and it's not going to take a lot more headaches for you to do it. So it's, I just thought I was curious about that.
Well, and the reason I kind of bring that up to begin with, you know, so there's about 2,500 items in there, 181 have sold, that those 181 items have brought in around $4,000. Mm. So in a 3.5 months period of time, let's just even say it's about $1,000 a month. Mm-hmm. The point I'm trying to get at is these are all small things that you can buy for $1, $2, and $3 a piece if you're buying them individually, or you can get them for even less than that per piece if you're buying lots of things. So if you're someone who's interested in buying and selling, and you don't even need to do it to get a full-time income, you could do what this worker is doing, just be the one that sources it yourself, and that's bringing in $1,000 a month. Yeah. So by the end of the year, that's $12,000. Now that's $12,000 is all the money. You have to take out your taxes, you have to take out your eBay fees and whatever your time is worth, but you're going to still end up after $12,000 with $9,000 or $10,000. And that sounds pretty good. Like, yeah, as a side hustle, that's not hard. It's not a difficult thing to do. And the types of items I'm selling are all stored in less than the space that is in one like storage rack, kind of like behind me if you're mm-hmm. watching on YouTube. And so it doesn't take up a ton of space. You could even fit it in a closet or in a dresser or something. It's out of sight. It doesn't take up a lot of space.
And you're talking a couple hours a day. You're not even talking about...
Not even that. Yeah, not even
like
that.
You're just maintaining this. So yeah, that would be a great side hustle. It would take some time to build it up and be reasonable about that. But I mean, yeah, I'm like, huh, how can I do that? You know, it'd be nice to have an extra grand a month for just maintaining something. But anyway... But we digress, Matt. What are we talking about today on the show?
So today I want to talk about, for people who are maybe are just starting out or are interested in this, I want to give you some advice. And that advice is, when you're out looking for items, there are a handful of things that you should purchase and have on hand when you're out looking at things. I'm going to talk about three specific things today. Well, four. And I'm going to show you pictures of those and discuss them. Level two would be a couple of other things, which I'll briefly mention today. Maybe we'll go into more detail later, that are not necessary, but if you kind of want to level up, that would be the next phase. So then the first two important things that you're going to want to have are a magnet and a loop. A loop is just a small magnifying glass, or even if just a small magnifying glass, but a loop is usually what a jeweler would use to look at a ring or a stone or something mm-hmm. like that. So I'm going to hold this up. This is just one that's on my desk. It's got a plastic handle, but at the end is a magnet. So a magnet is the first thing I'm going to mention. And a magnet is mostly for inspecting or testing jewelry when you're out in a store. You can buy very, very small ones. You carry it in your pocket. They cost next to nothing. I would recommend getting as strong of one as you can possibly get. I think they're called rare earth magnets or something, but they're very, very strong. Mm-hmm. They're like a magnet. I don't know if you know this, but in CD players, in vehicles, in that there are magnets on either side. And so when you put that in, it actually is hovering between these. But if you ever, like if someone's just throwing something away, you could probably find one for free out there. But the magnets in those are very strong and those are awesome. They're small and you want to be careful if you, you know, have a smartphone. You don't want to have this magnet in the pocket with your smartphone to mess something up. But you want to have a magnet. And the reason is when you're, say, at a thrift store, an antique store, and you're looking at jewelry and you suspect that it might be made out of silver or gold, silver and gold, sterling silver, and even 10 karat gold are not magnetic. So gold and silver are not magnetic. So if you put a magnet up to something you suspect is silver in it and it grabs onto it, you know it's not silver. So now your calculation or how you view that's going to be differently. Same thing with gold. That's the sort of the very first easiest way of testing something, and you can just do it right there. No one will even notice. It's just like you're handling it and inspecting it. So carry a magnet around with you. I have one. I have a couple here in the office. I have one in each of my vehicles just because I don't know what vehicle I'm going to take out that mm-hmm. day, but I've got it. It's in the console or it's in the glove compartment. A magnet. You can get them probably for free. You can get them very cheaply.
I wonder how many people listening to the show did what I did when you said silver and gold with a... Silver and gold,
and gold,
silver and
yes.
gold. Yeah, anyway, sorry, I went back to my famous, I think it's Santa Claus is coming down, but
you,
anyway.
It was. It was Santa Claus. Yeah. It was the snowman that was singing it, right? Yeah. Burl Ives.
The old Burl Ives, exactly. Anyway, right. Sorry. I've digressed. Let's talk.
No,
so
I mean,
we have a magnet. We have a magnet. And what's the loop?
He understood that. Absolutely. Santa Claus understood that. So you need to understand that.
Absolutely.
So the next thing is a loop, as I mentioned. Got a couple of different examples. There's all kinds of different ones with different strengths as far as like how much they magnify. Here's one that kind of folds up into itself. It's got two different sizes. One's smaller, one's larger. They're just two different magnification amounts. This is a 30 by 22 millimeter and a 60 by 12 millimeter.
We put some links for these two things? Maybe I can put them in the show notes.
I can find something. Yeah. You can buy all these things I'm talking about. You can buy it at Walmart. You can buy it on Amazon. Okay. You can buy, these are not hard to find items, and there's tons of different examples. Here's another one. This is a little bit older of a loop, and it folds out, and it has three different ones. And so this is partly like how close up are you need to look, and also how good is your eyesight?
Yeah.
But these are all tiny. I mean, these are like the size of a quarter in diameter, and so they just fit in your pocket. Here's another one that's a little bit larger that you look through on one side. It's just round. It doesn't fold up. And this is an 8x magnification, but I have like an 8, a 16, and maybe a 32. I got just different sizes here, as you can see. You just put them up, and you can look. So the reason you're going to want to have a loop is that on things like jewelry, or maybe you're looking at a postcard and you can't quite make out the date stamp on it and you want to see, or maybe it's a real photo postcard of an aerial view of a town or a street view of a town, and it doesn't say what it is. But if you get in there with that loop or that magnifying glass, you can go down, you can see a street sign, or you can see the name of a company on a bank. Or sometimes I've even had ones that had like a calendar out, and like I could actually, or there was like a clock, and I could see the exact time of day, and I ended up figuring out where it was. And it was like, this is like 3:22 in the afternoon on this date in this town, like on the street, which is really cool.
Because
if it's a 100-year-old postcard, that's just a really cool, you're seeing that exact snapshot in time. So having these are nice. Because on jewelry, on the backs, oftentimes, if it's a ring, it would be on the inside. If it's a necklace, it would be behind a pendant or on the clasp. If it's silver or gold, not always, but a lot of times, it's going to have a mark on it. It's going to say either the brand name of the company that produced it, or it's going to have the mark for the content of whatever the metal is. If it's silver, it's going to say 900 or 925 or 950. Or it's going to say STER, S-T-E-R, for sterling silver. Mm. If it's gold, it could have a variety of marks depending on if it was made in in the UK or in Europe or in the United States. Precious metals don't always have stamps, but ones that are usually 100 years old or newer will, because purity standards required that. Prior to that, they did not. So having a magnet is going to be a really good thing as an initial, my gut tells me this might be made of silver or gold. You test it with the magnet. Okay, it passes that. Great. Now let's look and see if there's any kind of mark on this. You're going to examine that with your loop, and you're going to look at it. Okay? Any questions so far?
When you pulled out the loop, I was thinking of myself in my wool suit with my stick pin and my monocle and my and my pocket watch that we've talked about on the show. I'm like,
exactly.
Pulling out, I've always seen the movie where the guy pulls out his thing, and I always... I guess the question, do you ever get into this? And maybe you don't. I know you have some training with precious gems and thing, but I've always thought that the reason they pulled that out is they wanted to look at the quality of the stone. Do you ever get into that at all?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Okay. Oh, yeah. In fact, last, I guess it's been 2 weeks ago. So I frequent several places, like, continuously, sometimes every week, sometimes once a month. But the point is, it's in my community. I've been doing it for years now. And so I have relationships with a lot of these people at these places I go to. They know who I am. They know my name. We have conversations. And in this particular instance, spending the time to get to know a person and be a frequent customer of theirs meant that we end up having a conversation about jewelry, that I sell jewelry. Oh, I've got a bunch of this stuff that I haven't put out yet. Turns out to be a bunch of sterling silver jewelry and things. But he also had some stones. Now, I live in North Carolina. North Carolina is one of the states that has, if not the most, one of the most variety of natural minerals and gemstones that form in the state. And it's because we're so mountainous, particularly the western part of the state. And so he had some loose, uncut stones. He had some garnet. There were some sapphires and some rubies. not rubies, sorry, emeralds. And then he had some facet cut diamonds that presumably had been pulled from some jewelry, and they were just loose. They were cut. One was probably a carat and a half round cut diamond, and then three or four more diamonds. And he's like, hey, you know, we were having this conversation about what I was going to pay for it, but I needed to inspect those stones, particularly the facet cut stones, because again, presumably if it's a facet cut stone, it's good enough quality to be cut in that way for them to spend the time to do it, to put it into jewelry. So I looked at it, and what I'm looking for is there any damage around like the edge of it on the bottom? Is it, you know, diamonds are the toughest substance on earth. So they're not easily, you're not often going to find scratches, but you might find cracks. You might find inclusions, which are mineral deposits or different imperfections in how it's being formed. Mm-hmm. And diamonds can come like brown or black. They can come yellow, orange. They can be opaque. They can be translucent. So these particular diamonds were really poor quality. They looked fine from a distance, but when you get that loop out, there's some heavy black lines inside of it, inclusion. Mm. So very, very low quality stones. So that changes what I would be willing to pay for something like that if I'm even interested at that point. So yes, if you're inspecting a piece of jewelry and it has authentic stones, or maybe you're not sure if it's glass or a stone, get that out and look at it. Now you're going to need some training, right? You're going to need to have looked at some things before or have done some research. Otherwise, you're not going to know what you're looking at. But I use that to look at stones. But this was more for kind of advice for beginners. So if you don't have great eyesight, if you can't look inside of a ring at a very tiny thing and tell what it says, then you need a magnifying glass to look at that. I use one. I have very good vision, thankfully. I was very lucky. And so a lot of times I can tell without using the loop, but it's good to have one, because I guarantee you the day you forget to take it with you, it's just like business cards. You know, right. You take business cards around with you. Like, why am I carrying these all the time? Nobody ever wants these. And then you'd leave them home and they're like, hey, do you have a business card? Yes, I do. I didn't bring it today.
I'll have to email it to you. Goes.
Exactly. Yeah. So magnet, a loop. The next two things are not necessary, but are also handy to have. One is a little scale. And I'm holding one up that is roughly, you can tell by the size of it, it's roughly the size of like a smartphone that you might carry in your pocket. It's lighter than a phone. But what it is it's a small scale that you can put something on and weigh it. The particular one that I have in my hand will weigh things. It has different modes. You can weigh things by the gram, the ounce. You can do carat weight. So if it was like a gemstone, for example, it would tell you the carat weight of it. Ounces, there's a few different ones, but I primarily use the grams and the carat one because those are the things I'm weighing. You don't have to carry this inside of a store with you. I would say if there's ever a situation where you would want to use it, you could just say, hey, do you mind if I go get a scale? I'll be right back. And people are like, yeah. I mean, they're wanting to sell something. So if you can investigate it, determine that you want to buy it, perfect. But this is nice for like in the car. So
what's that run cost-wise, roughly?
There's different brands. You know what I mean? It's like anything you can get them for as little as probably $10, $10, $12. Okay. Everything that I'm showing you and discussing today, cumulatively, all four of these items, probably $40 or $50 or less total for all of these. You get them all at one time and you've made that investment and now you're going to use them for years.
Right.
Provided you don't lose them or damage them. The reason a scale like this is important is if you want to do some of that investigation on the weight of something after you've bought it. So I'm again talking about things like jewelry or gemstones and things like that have monetary value attached to them, simply the substance itself. So if it's a costume jewelry, there's a lot of variables to determine the value of it, the brand, the make, what the materials are. But if it's gold or silver, every day, gold, 1 gram of gold or 1 gram of silver, depending on the purity, has a very hard set value. Mm-hmm. It's a commodity that's traded. And so every morning I'll get up and I'll see what is 14 karat gold selling for today per gram, or what is sterling silver per gram. And I'm armed with that knowledge as I go out into the world. So if I end up buying a piece of jewelry that's made of 14 karat gold, I can go out. If I decide to buy it based on what I think it weighs, or I weigh it with this scale, then I know exactly what I'm going to be able to sell it for if I'm only selling it for the weight of the gold. Then you take it out, you weigh it. I have a little bit of a cheat, and this is something that if you don't have a scale yet, or if you feel like you could do what I'm about to say, go for it. I have a wedding ring that I wear, and it is 18 karat gold. So it's a high purity of gold, and it's about 6.5 grams. So it's a pretty wide band, and it's pretty heavy. I know exactly what the weight of this is, and most rings or small pieces of jewelry are going to be 6 to 8 grams or less. Most small rings, women's rings, are more like in the 1.5 to 3 grams, even if they have stones a lot of times, like wedding bands and things. So I'll put the item in one hand and I'll put my ring in the other. And I know this one weighs 6.5 grams. So I'm kind of saying to myself, this is just a touch thing. Like, how much do I think that this really is? Mm. You can also, you don't have to be something you wear, but like if you have anything that you know the weight of it, you could take with you as like a proxy that can help you. Mm-hmm. But if you have the scale, then just weigh it right then. And so that's nice to have with you. So you're testing it to see if it's magnetic. You're inspecting it to see if you can gather further information from marks that are on it and to determine if it's real gemstones or not. We can do a whole episode on identifying what gemstone is what, yeah, but that's not today. So weighing metals, things like that, you're going to want to know what the base value is. So when I'm buying something that's a gram and I know that 14 karat gold is selling for 42 grams today, then I need to know that whatever cost they're wanting me to, you know, whatever the cost is, I think I can sell it for that as a baseline and still take out taxes and still take out fees and still stand to earn whatever I am needing to earn mm-hmm. by spending that amount of money.
Cool.
The next thing real quick is this item, and this is a digital caliper. And so this item is just kind of long, and it has these sort of like claw pincher type things at the end. And it's got two different sides. One is to kind of, it has like a slider, like a ruler, right? And then you can slide this digital thing on it, and it actually calculates in millimeters what the size of a thing is. This is good for things like jewelry or gemstones to determine what the size is. You can put a thing on the inside of it and measure it, or if you're wanting to measure the inside of something, you can flip it around and slide it the opposite direction and determine the inside width. Like if I wanted to determine the diameter of my ring, I could do that. I know what my ring size is, but if I'm finding something out in the wild, then I don't know. This is important because you're going to want to at least have this at home, if not with you on the road, because when you get back, you're going to need to accurately describe this before you sell it. So you're going to want to know. Another thing I didn't show today is a mandrel, which is like that long tube that you would put a ring on. It's a ring sizer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So again, that doesn't have to be on the road with you, but it's nice to have it. You buy a ring, you're going to come back. You want to know that it's a size 7.5 before you list it. Otherwise, you're not going to find the right buyer. So this is nice if I have a loose gemstone and I want to give as much detailed information as possible. So it's not just an emerald. It's an emerald specimen that weighs 0.64 grams that was found in Spruce Pine, North Carolina at a particular mine. And it's, I don't know, 5 millimeters in diameter.
Mm.
Now I can't know that unless I have the tools to tell me that.
Right.
And that's why it's nice to have that. So a scale, a caliper to determine sizes of small items, a magnet, and a loop. Those are all inexpensive things by themselves, $10 to $15 a piece or less. And it's going to really save you from making some bad decisions or some impulsive decisions about a thing, having to risk, well, if it is the gold, you know, if it is, I can sell over this. You get home and you test it and you're like, it's not. Wish right. I had these things with me when I was there. And you know what, guys, this is do what I say, don't do what I do. Because you know what, half the time I go out and I don't have all of these things right. with me. And it's so, but I should. But I also am bad about losing things.
Well, this seems like an idea. I'm a big, big believer in having the right tools. I always talk to my wife and my daughter. I'm like, you never think about it until you absolutely need it. So do you have the right size clamp? Or, you know, I saw the caliper. I have a caliper that I use for all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that I would recommend, Matt clearly doesn't do this, but I would recommend this, is get a little, for that, all these items are fairly small, get a little clasp pencil box.
So yeah, like a little pouch or something.
A little pouch or something that you could put these in. I do this when I go out and do sound stuff. I carry this little box, and it's got all the tools that I need. It's not everything. So you're probably not carrying every single thing you need, but it's the key ones that you keep in your car, or you keep in your truck or whatever you have. And that way, when you need it, you have it. So as Matt said, do what he says, not what he does.
Yeah, I'm gonna jump on your back on this and add, go out today to a thrift store and buy the fanny pack that has the brightest neon colors, oranges and greens and yellows,
yes.
And put it in that. And then every time you get out to go in the store, you strap that puppy on.
Good luck
waist.
Finding a fanny pack right now. They're so popular, I doubt you would find them. But they don't wear them around there. They wear them over their shoulders now, Matt. It's a whole different beast going on. The young Sparkies, they just do things differently. Well, listen, we are out of time. We will be back with a new episode. This has been super helpful for those of you that are just starting out. We will put these links in there. Remember to like, follow, subscribe. One thing that would be very helpful or maybe helpful for you is find the Facebook page with the pictures on it and just subscribe to that page so that you can find it every time. I've noticed that people are starting to subscribe, so that's just super helpful. We'll have all the images in the episode along with, if Matt doesn't send them to me, I'm going to find some links to drop in there so that you guys can at least get an idea of what he's talking about.
Yep.
Otherwise, any last words, Matt?
I don't think so. Go get this stuff. Have them. You're not going to be, you're going to be very happy that you have them, for sure.
Excellent. All right. Talk to you guys soon.